Today, no sex, please. We're British.
Most of our friends were hard-pressed to understand why something with a title like No Sex Please, We're British could inspire my return to the theatre. The play, a typically English sex farce by Anthony Marriott and Alastair Foote, was all about a young, newly married bank manager who discovers there is pornography being delivered to his bank branch because of a mistaken address. Everything is further complicated by the imminent visit of a bank inspector, the appearance of a disapproving mother-in-law, and a couple of nearly naked girls arriving for some sort of sex convention. The manager assigns his weedy, awkward junior clerk the job of disposing of the porn. And, well, you can imagine the rest. I spoke to John Gale, the producer, and suggested that instead of playing the bank manager, I would far rather play the bank clerk. I thought I could do more with the part, which to my mind combines some wonderful elements of pathos with grand opportunities for knockdown slapstick comedy. So Anthony Valentine was cast as the bank manager, Linda Thorson as his wife, and that grand and wonderful theatrical institution, Evelyn Lay, as the grand dame mother-in-law. I was Brian Runnicles, the neurotically nervous, bumbling junior clerk. The script wasn't terribly strong, so rehearsals became, of necessity, an imaginatively creative time. Tony Valentine and I spent hours together improvising and shaping physical bits to add to the evening. For instance, there were piles of huge books positioned on the stage, so we invented all sorts of sight gags using the books as props, with me staggering under their weight or balancing and juggling great stacks of them on my knees while I attempted to answer a telephone. And I did lots of jumps and leaps through the hatch of a tiny onstage kitchenette. I enjoyed a particular piece of business in one scene when I was chased into the bathroom by two half-naked girls. Not a bad way to earn a quid. Shortly thereafter, I re-emerged, clad only in my shorts, and appearing completely comatose as I was carried across the stage, sitting on the shoulders of a large, luscious lady. My arms were held high over my head in a kind of stupefied pose. In rehearsals, when the actress carrying me reached the door, we both realized my body was positioned too high to go through it. So to solve the problem, I had a picture solidly bolted to the wall above the door. She could walk through it, but I was left hanging by both hands from the picture above the archway. Then, still seeming to be totally unconscious, I let one hand drop down while the rest of my body, hanging by one arm from the picture, swung at a snail's pace round to face the audience. It used to bring the house down. We were scheduled to open in Scotland. What a place, I thought, to take an English farce on opening night. It's part of theatrical folklore that English comedies and comedians go to Glasgow to die. Every music hall comic I've ever met can tell alarming tales of being pelted with rotten vegetables by an unappreciative audience of Scotsmen. I was dreading the opening, only hoping that the men of Edinburgh would be of a gentler disposition than their Glaswegian compatriots. On the afternoon of our final dress run, the company stood together on stage waiting for comments from the authors, Messrs. Foote and Marriott, who'd been watching from their seats in the stalls. Mr. Marriott seemed genuinely pleased. Mr. Foote, on the other hand, was conspicuously and unaccountably silent, until someone addressed him and discovered he was dead. The poor man, unnoticed by anyone, had died during the dress run. It was only a matter of time, of course, before there were dark jokes about what had happened. Did anyone happen to notice if he was laughing when he died? But as you can appreciate, the death of one of the authors did very little to calm our opening night jitters. In fact, we needn't have worried at all. The Edinburgh audiences were warmly receptive and kept us in full houses. The show moved on to Manchester, to the Opera House there, much too large a theatre for such a farce, and we didn't do as well. But Tony and Linda and I spent every waking hour at the theatre devising, improvising and sharpening new business for our opening night in London. By the time the curtain went up at the Strand Theatre in June of 1971, our ensemble playing was honed to as near comic perfection as we could make it. Gabrielle and I went out to dinner after the opening and later drove on to the West London Air Terminal for the early editions of the papers. The reviews for the play itself were fairly reserved, but praise for our company was unanimous. And a few days later, the eminent theatre critic of the Sunday Times, Harold Hobson, wrote a review I shall always treasure, calling my characterization a creation of innocent beauty and also of athletic skill, which makes one proud of the theatre. Creating a character on stage is partly a matter of growing into that imaginary person's natural rhythm. Where in a sentence does that emphatic nod come? When, during an aggressive confrontation, does that characteristic twitch of the leg betray the seething nerves under the calm exterior? In comedy generally, and particularly on screen, much of it can be almost subliminal. But in onstage farce, you can make every inch of your body work for you. Farce, you'll often find, is based usually on a highly dramatic situation. And as that drama unfolds, it's possible to allow your body to be racked by the turmoil of each moment, as if moving ever more and more out of your control. Fuses are going off down one part of the body after another. A lot of people playing fast make the mistake of sacrificing character to timing. I don't think that works. If you don't believe in the truth of the character, you won't laugh or cry with them. And surely this applies to all forms of drama. I have a memory from when I was very small of Nan, my grandmother, and Mont, my grandfather, struggling to carry a wardrobe downstairs. Mum offered to help, but don't interfere, said Mont. We know what we're doing. We work as a team. Mum and I gave each other a look. Inevitably, the weight of the wardrobe proved too much for Nan, who sat down heavily on the stairs, letting go of the wardrobe so that the whole burden fell on Mont, who was supporting it from below. He fell backwards. The wardrobe slid down the stairs, revealing Nan's legs akimbo and the never-seen bloomers that dwelt underneath. And as the back of Mont's head hit the hall carpet, the door of the wardrobe swung open and a plaster statue of the Virgin Mary with child shot out, sailed through the air and hit Mont right between the eyes. With a little clink, the baby Jesus' head fell off. Later we glued it back on, but it was forever afterwards a bit askew. The baby's head embedded in Mary's bosom, which is maybe why we kept it in the cupboard under the stairs after that. Now, if I were trying to recreate this scene on stage, there would be two things I'd emphasize. Firstly, the pomposity of Nan and Mont so that their comeuppance is funny. And secondly, how the consequences of this initial pomposity accelerate out of control. Not long after the opening of No Sex, Please, I got a call from John Barry asking if I would be interested in playing the role of the White Rabbit in a musical film of Alice in Wonderland, for which he was writing the score. Bill Sterling, the director, assured me that my scenes would be shot early in the day, allowing plenty of time to return to the theatre at night. But the schedule turned out to be far more grueling than anything I could have imagined. Worse still, it left very little time for a home life. And the physical stress of exhaustion and my continuing absence from home began to add to the existing strains on our marriage. In the years following my meeting and falling in love with Gabrielle, I began for the first time to get a lot of recognition, particularly from the opposite sex. I'd never had this attention before. Now, suddenly I had choices, and my ridiculous male ego was enormously flattered. How does a man's mind work so that he believes that an infidelity won't interfere with the love that stands at the center of his life? Of all the mistakes that one can make, this one ranks right up there with the worst. And then I'm afraid I compounded the hurt. I told Gabrielle what I'd done. As a Catholic, you think of confession in terms of doing penance and receiving absolution. But Gabrielle never trusted me completely again. And I'm sure I would have been exactly the same if it had been the other way round. Arguments gave way to long periods of resentful silence. Terrible weeks for both of us, and I didn't help matters by continually escaping to the refuge of the theatre, sometimes arriving in the afternoon for an 8 o'clock curtain. I moved out of our Wimbledon home in November 1972. It was fairly clear in Gabrielle's mind that our marriage was over, although at the time I adamantly refused to admit it to myself. I had always been a passionate football fan and loved going to matches, but the whole thing bored Gabrielle. I used to keep at her about it. "Look, if we've got to get ourselves together," I told her, "we have to be part of things for each other, so why don't you come to the football games?" This kind of argument went on for months until she finally relented and came to a Chelsea match with me. Ironically, she ended up living with the centre forward for Chelsea and had two children by him. I hate to say I told you so, but I knew she'd enjoy herself once she actually been to a match. However much I love Gabrielle, I don't think I loved her enough. But at the same time, I don't think I could have loved her more. Perhaps if we'd met later on when I was more mature, it would have lasted. Our friends were supportive and helpful. The astrologer Patrick Walker and his friend Martin Thomas suggested I come out and stay with them in their vacation home in Spain, an invitation they'd live to regret. The minute I got off the plane, my first words were, "Do you think I've done the right thing by coming here?" And from that moment, I proceeded to drive them absolutely crazy. All I really wanted to do was go home. Patrick was particularly patient. He drove me to the airport almost every day. Halfway there, I'd decide not to go, and he'd have to drive me all the way back to the house again. Eventually, the day came when I decided it was time to go. I even booked myself on the afternoon flight to London. This time, rather than risk another 2-hour drive to the airport, Patrick and Martin put me in a taxi in the joyful realization they wouldn't have to put up with me for another day. Patrick had a dinner party that evening, although not, he swore, to celebrate my departure. His guests were sitting on the terrace enjoying the sunset when a taxi pulled up. "Oh, God, no," Patrick said. "It can't be." It was. My flight had been cancelled. "Why didn't you just sleep at the airport?" Patrick asked me. "I mean, did you have to come back? I mean, well, it's not that we didn't want you." I left for good the next morning. I'm sure there was dancing in the streets. Mike Summerby, who played football for both Manchester City and England, was another great friend. He called me that first Christmas after Gabrielle and I separated, urging me to spend the holiday with his family. I was feeling completely miserable, not least for having contracted chickenpox. "Well, the kids have got to get chickenpox sometime," Mike insisted. "They might as well get it all at once." I might even have welcomed having chickenpox that holiday weekend had I known I was carrying a Christmas present of unimagined proportions. A script for a new television program called Some Mothers Do Have 'Em.